guys, it is Monday, the 17th of November, which means it's that time of the month again, our monthly meetings, and we would normally introduce you to Tim Humphrey, but Tim has been called away, and so an able replacement is here. Oh, you're going to love him, actually. Carl Melford. And why I say you're going to love him is Carl is the guy who is in charge of emergency management, and I am hearing something else, and I don't know what it is. That's a wonder. Well, we'll start again and say hi to Carl, who has an official title that I undoubtedly screwed up. So, Carl, what is it?
Gila County Emergency Manager. And when you introduced me, the guitar started, so it almost sounded like you were introducing a local guitarist. I do play, but I'm not that good.
That's great. That is great. Yeah, I'll have to add that to my notes saying just turn off the volume on the backup, because we've tried a few times to cause it not to back up, but apparently... Yeah, computers, the bane of all of our existence.
Yeah, we need them, but can't live with them, can't live without them in today's day and age.
It's true, and I'll say on the air that a while ago we were talking to Carl about EAS and the importance of using radio in an emergency. Carl is on board with that. Unfortunately, he doesn't have the backbone for it because there's no one in the state who's helping. There's no one else in the county who's helping. It's a problem that is unfortunately nationwide as well as Arizona, and we're going to work on it, but beating up on Carl is probably not the way to go because, again, he came into this job and they didn't even tell him there was EAS. So there's a bigger problem. And I would assume in emergency management that while it's not really your responsibility, because it can't be, but it's worrisome that we don't have that as a backup source.
Yes, I know they used to have a lot of support for EAS, and now it's impossible to get a hold of anybody that knows what they're doing. And unfortunately, there's no responsible party at a higher level of government. So with any other function in government, and particularly in emergency management, there's that next step up in government where you can call in for help. And it just doesn't exist with EAS.
Yeah, and this is a problem nationwide. And when the FCC recently came up saying, well, maybe we'll have to rely on what they call CAP IPAWS, but it's a computerized system, scares the living daylights out of me, because fortunately, in a flood, you're not so far gone, and boy, we're going to be talking about the floods, that you can't rely on things like Everbridge or whatever. But in a real bona fide emergency, you will not have the internet in any configuration, and radio should be in the equation. So that's all we'll say about that. But don't beat up directly on Carl for that. We'll try to beat up on people above him. All right. So now for that, you actually earned your money in the.
I'd say so. Yeah. It's been a busy time, and you know, it's a unique position in emergency management because we're doing a lot, but a lot of it's behind the scenes. So very rare are you going to see emergency management out in a disaster scene, but know well that those people are definitely earning their keep on the back end.
Oh, yeah. And of course, what happened, and we're going to kind of review this because I know there's been a lot of discussion about this, because these weather events in the past month have affected a lot of people. And with that in mind, let's talk about it from the first storm on, because that was not storm singular. What happened in Globe and Miami was actually two storms.
Technically, we can look at it as three events, because we had, let me pull my dates up here, so a lot of these days are blurred together. So let me kind of go through how this came about.
Sure.
From my standpoint. So I'm a executive board member on the Arizona Association of Emergency Managers, and we were having our conference. I actually had a speaking part on this particular Thursday. And right after my speaking part, I started looking at the weather, and I'm like, oh no, we need to start packing up. Like, this is not looking good. There's a concentrated cell just pulling up on Miami on that far side of the telegraph scar. And right around that time, my 9-year-old son calls me, and he's crying. He's like, Mom's stuck. Mom's stuck. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? So I hang up, and I call his mom and ask, hey, what's going on? And she said, well, I'm trying to go up Golden Hill right now, and it's raining so hard I pulled over, and now my car is washing down the hill. And
oh,
I'm just flabbergasted, because that's not an area we're accustomed to seeing any kind of flooding like this, even after Telegraph. So I'm gathering my stuff as quick as I can.
Yeah.
I try not to think about what I may have left in that hotel room. I haven't missed it yet, so it can't be that important. And directing her to, you know, back into somebody's driveway. I don't care whose, just throw it in reverse. And so we get flying back into town, and we get into Miami, and we're right in the thick of it. Like, the water's just subsided. There's debris everywhere. And we start doing a preliminary damage assessment. Mind you, my entire emergency management department is myself and one other person. We quickly realized we were in over our heads, especially that we could not get off of Highway 60 in pretty much either direction in the canyons that we needed to in Miami. So we photographed what we could from the vantage points of what we could, started putting in requests to the state for support, because that's what we do when we reach situations where we're not, the two of us are not going to be enough. And went into Walmart, photographed that. They got flooded pretty bad.
Yeah.
Miami High School.
Cal Ranch.
Yes, Cal Ranch, pretty much that entire plaza. Mm-hmm.
You're right, Beals, a lot of clothes.
Oh, yeah. Went home for the day. I don't even remember what time. Came in early Friday. Started making contact with the state to reach out to Team Rubicon, Salvation Army, the Red Cross, a lot of those non-government organizations that can come out and help, and start getting them rolling and collect some more preliminary damage assessments. And that brings us to the 26th at about 6:45. I get a call from the dispatch supervisor, who's been there for as long as I can remember, probably as long as I've been around. And I've worked with this woman for a long time. I've never heard her shook like this. And she wasn't sure if it was a hoax call or what, but she was getting calls from the canyons, people saying they're climbing on top of their roofs. Those 911 calls start going into downtown Globe. So I had just sent my employee Justin home about 20-30 minutes prior to that. So I call him to see if he can come back in, and he calls me from Haskins Bridge, because he lives up that direction. Says, I can't make it in. The bridge is completely underwater. And he said, I'm seeing vehicles. I'm seeing propane tanks. The smell of propane is awful. So I told him, you know, hey, go the long way around and come out on Highway 60 by DeMarco's. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, he can't get that out there either. So I'm trying to get that direction, but I cannot, because traffic is already backed up to Hilltop. So I pull back to our office in Central Heights, and I can smell the propane from there. So I start calling in resources, the incident management teams, incident management assistance teams, our NGOs. It was basically an all hands on deck situation, and it was a lot. And I was really happy to see the amount of support that we got coming in. I mean, we saw not only on the law enforcement side, but fire, medical, search and rescue, mm-hmm. with patches from all over the state.
Which is absolutely great. But yeah, so what started out thinking Wednesday the 24th, well, we're going to get a storm, it's not going to be great, but no way were you looking at, and then we're going to get another storm from another direction, and we're going to wind up being swamped.
You know, and those, and the concentration of those storms too, like looking back at the radar, I mean, I was watching the them both live, and the way that they concentrated and almost followed the watershed down, I mean, it was just kind of packing water on top of water, not to mention there was rain beforehand, so there was no soil absorption. All that water is coming down at a fast rate.
In that scenario, because there's a lot of people who are saying, oh, well, this should have been foreseen, like it could have been, but what could have been done, if anything? Or was this just, you are a sitting duck when this is a freak of nature and it happens?
That's pretty much what it boils down to. I mean, we've seen rain events before. I've never seen this concentrated of rain in one singular spot. And it's a question that came up a lot during the Telegraph. Well, how much rain fell on the burn scar? You know, it's a 100,000 plus acre burn scar. Right. It may be a concentrated pocket over here, a small amount of rain over here, and there's very few rain gauges. Where this cell concentrated at its peak, there were no rain gauges in that area. We just don't have the coverage. Right. There's hardly anywhere in the state that has that precise of coverage to catch every little concentrated area of every storm. So I believe what our flood control engineer said was it's in the neighborhood of a 175-year storm.
Yeah, and of course, that's an estimate. It could happen next year as well, so you hope it doesn't. But looking at that, I know there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks here, but in terms of, and I think that's what the public is most concerned about, you know, what can we do in the event, if anything? Now, of course, my first answer is always make sure you're insured. Because what percentage of people are not? Oh, John says I should give out the phone number. So I will, by the way, if you want to join in. And that's 888 876-5593. 888-876-5593. All right. And you might not know this because it's way out of your wheelhouse, but what percentage of people here are insured for flood?
I believe that we had around 70, this is a ballpark number, so don't hold me to this, but 70 to 80% uninsured entirely. And that's not even specific to flood, because the flood insurance costs here are outrageous.
Well, right, and I think a lot of people who do have insurance, the people who are in that other 20 to 30%, most of them automatically think they have flood insurance, because it's not the kind of thing that you realize is exempt from a policy.
Correct.
So what we're saying probably is upwards of 90% or greater did not have flood insurance, whether they had any insurance at all.
That's fair.
That's a huge number. It's also a huge number in terms of for people who are going to want to try and maybe put a second mortgage on their house and all this. They may not be able to get that, especially in areas where there's no sewers, which we've talked about, and because Tri-City is still years away. So what are we looking at in terms of economic cost?
Well, the economic costs are massive, especially on the individual. I mean, you know, let's say we've got a resident that lives in one of these areas, their home was flooded, they had that expectation that they were insured, and they're not. And that's a lot of what we're seeing. That's probably the most difficult part of this job, is we're getting phone calls from people saying like, hey, my house flooded and my insurance isn't covering it. What can we do? And that's where we brought in folks like the Salvation Army, who has that that method and that the infrastructure to vet and provide donations that have come in to the individuals, partnering them with the United Fund, who is able to accept those donations on behalf of the community. And let me kind of break down that for
sure,
you, if you don't mind, because
absolutely,
there's a lot of confusion there. People ask, you know, why did, is it Salvation Army or is it United Fund? Well, it's both. And the reason is, so the United Fund can accept donations and keep them local. If you donate directly to the Salvation Army, yes, you're supporting local, but you may also be supporting the next emergency that they deploy to, because it goes into their funding.
So they might not be local.
Correct. Which is no fault of their own.
No,
that's the way they're built. Yes.
Right.
So donating directly to the United Fund of Globe Miami makes sure that those donations stay local. And on top of that, the Salvation Army has the metrics and the staffing that people can apply, and they can vet, and then they can disperse those funds, where the United Fund does not have that kind of manpower. So basically, we've got two halves of a great working system that we've put together, and that's helping to get what financial support we can to the individuals.
Now, with regard to United Fund, it's great that they take the donations and then they have them here locally, but it was my understanding that they're not the ones who necessarily determine where they're going?
So Salvation Army is who, it will stay local, but as far as who the recipients are, those are vetted by the Salvation Army.
Okay.
Because they do that for disasters regularly.
So, because I've heard some people say, well, I don't want to give to United Fund because that'll be political and they give to who they want, but ultimately they don't decide that at all. They're just collecting the donations.
Correct. So Salvation Army will be distributing funds, and then at the end of the day they say, you know, I paid out this person out of your community, that total amount is this. United Fund pays Salvation Army. So
okay,
that's the way we've kind of, this was something that we slapped together during the Telegraph fire, and that worked fairly well. And no system's perfect, but this ensures that, you know, at the end of the day, if there's a large amount of donations that haven't been distributed yet, they don't go to another disaster somewhere else. And I know that sounds...
No, it absolutely makes sense. Now, with that in mind, is the Salvation Army making these determinations locally? In other words, whoever's deciding where the money's going locally, is that person here?
Yes, we actually have two local Salvation Army representatives. And again, I say they're staffed for it. It is two, but they are doing such a great job, and they're both locals.
Good. All right. Now, is there anybody else involved in this, Chamber of Commerce or something like this?
Yeah, Chamber of Commerce, like right now, they Chamber of Commerce, I was genuinely impressed with early on, because they established kind of a spur of the moment. There's a lot of terms for it in the emergency management world. We used to call it a CRC, Community Resource Center.
Mm-hmm.
Now, DAC is used, Disaster Assistance Center, or a DAC. They established somewhat of a DAC there. They were accepting those physical donations and then making them available for the public. Stuff as simple as cleanup kits that volunteers could take into downtown. They established that early on, and then when the SBA, the Small Business Association, arrived, they gave them a place to work out of in partnership with them.
Good. Good. So now we're over a month later. Where are we?
So the SBA's gotten quite a bit of applications. I don't have a final number yet. Fun fact about the SBA that I didn't even know coming into this, those loans are also available for homeowners, even though they're a small business association. Yeah, so if you're looking to rebuild your home, pop in the Chamber of Commerce and talk with the SBA or visit them online and turn in an application. They're low-interest loans. And again, they are loans. They will be something that needs to be paid back. But from my understanding, because I probed them with all the questions when they got here, because I'm somebody who's financially hesitant when getting into those kind of situations. Sure. So there was a guarantee to me that there's no interest in the first 12 months.
Okay.
So if you needed to, say, get $12,000 in supplies, but you had the means to pay $1,000 a month to get it back, at the end of that term, there's no interest.
That's great.
So it is good, and you know, if you're in a tough situation, especially for the uninsured, it's not an amazing option, but it may be the best one out there.
Well, and also if you're not qualifying for traditional loans or, you know, second mortgages or whatever. Now, speaking of that, in terms of being able to rebuild, again, a good swath of this area is not served by any public sewer, and unfortunately is not on septic and not able to be on septic because the lots are too small. So with that in mind, now traditionally, the government, the EPA, has been adamant that we're not allowing you to rebuild. Is that happening here?
That's a little outside of my emergency wheelhouse, so I'm not sure. I haven't heard of it happening, but one thing that I can attest to, because it's another popular topic, people brought up FEMA buyouts. Well, you know, is FEMA going to buy out my home? I just want to be transparent here. Typically, in order to get that kind of a process started, we have to show a 4 to 5 year recurrence, an annual recurrence of flooding, and that doesn't exist here.
Right. And also, the other thing is, even if they did, what they'd appraise it at and what it might actually be worth are two completely different figures. So I don't think anybody should be looking at, like, well, FEMA will buy my home. In the unlikely event they would, it wouldn't be a good deal for you.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. So now here we are. Like I say, it's the aftermath, and it was nice to see restaurants reopening, which Friday occurred downtown, and people, I won't say getting back to normal, but being able to operate. So now, for individuals who are looking, and maybe they've been spared a lot of damage, what they can do going forward. Obviously, if you can get insurance, have insurance, but if you can't get it or you can't afford it, that's not necessarily going to be an option. So what can people do to protect themselves?
So one of the first things to do is know your area, because we ran into the situation with the Telegraph, like what to do in these flash flood occurrences, because the immediate thought is to evacuate. And oftentimes that's not the best case. Take, for example, you got Six Shooter Canyon, Kellner Canyon, and Ice House Canyon. Those roadways run along parallel with those watersheds, typically at a lower elevation than majority of the homes. And then there's two ways out of there. There's Connie's Bridge and then Beer Tree Crossing. We used to have the Russell Road back there, but that no longer exists. The likelihood of those two becoming impassable and now having a line of vehicles at a lower elevation at their homes is a dangerous and terrifying concept to me. So the best thing to do is have that sense of awareness that, you know, if I have a flash flood, if I have a two-story house, maybe the best option is going, you know, upstairs. Or my neighbor's house sits about 12 feet higher than mine. I'm going to run up to my neighbor's house. It's that life over property mentality, and I again wish there was a better option, but I mean, we live, and I can say we because I've been here my entire life, we live in a very mountainous terrain. We have canyons everywhere, and we need to be aware and understand what we need to do in those emergencies.
When we talk about things like preventing fires, which is, of course, something else you deal with regularly, we talk about all the things you can do, trimming the trees and getting rid of the junk and all the things. Is there anything like that that you can harden your situation for a flood, or are you just basically a sitting duck?
So there's some. So here's a good example, right? So a lot of the homes in the canyons, we get a lot of questions like, well, why hasn't the county done this with the watershed or that with the watershed? The county owns very, very little of the actual creeks themselves. There's good portions that are owned by mining properties, but or mining companies. But let's say, for example, you and I live in Six Shooter Canyon and we're across the creek from each other. There's a very good chance that our property line is the center of the creek, which means you and I own that portion of the creek and are responsible for it. And if the government comes in and cleans it up for us, is that a potential gift of public funds because they are providing a service to a private property owner?
And are you going to get a bill?
Yeah. And then that's a likelihood too, you know? So I think that, you know, if you're a property owner in a flood zone, look at the parcel map and see where your property lines are. In some of these scenarios where people have low water crossings that they also own, getting the debris out of the way ahead of those crossings can make a huge difference. Because I've heard the term before, you know, we need to slow the water down. That's not necessarily what we're trying to do. We want the water to pass through as quickly and easily as possible.
Right.
And be about its merry way and go down to Roosevelt Lake and, you know, oxygenate the fish down there. We don't want it here. So making sure that any of the watersheds on your property are clear of any kind of debris, and then things that you may have out on your property that are near the watershed, making sure that's either staked down somehow or just out of the way so it can't become debris for folks downstream.
Yeah, and be aware, obviously. It's a very frightening thing, and like we've talked before, when you see the Matlock propane tanks floating down the street and you're smelling gas, you know you've got a huge, huge problem. So I understand, I don't know if it's actually happening that they're relocating to higher ground or whatever, but no one could expect it, and here we are.
Yeah, and I know that those tanks aren't there anymore. That was another call that, so in the emergency operations center that I run, I bring in experts to sit in spots to make decisions from there. And ADEQ was one of the first ones we brought in. As soon as I heard there was a hazardous materials component, we brought ADEQ to have a seat at the table. We have this agreement in Arizona called the Mutual Aid Compact, which is similar to what law enforcement and fire has, providing mutual aid, but for emergency management. And we were able to activate both state and federal mutual aid during this disaster. I actually had a team come in, because at some point they, you know, do have to give us a little bit of support and send us home. I think I made it 36 consecutive days, until they brought in an incident management assistance team out of Pasco County, Florida, to come in. And they spent a few days with us, got comfortable, and were able to cycle out some of our people to get some rest. And it's another thing that's difficult, too, is when you're working with county staff that are local, you have to be kind of sensitive about, okay, who am I bringing in to work, and do I need to check on them first to make sure that their property is okay and that they themselves are okay?
Right, and when you are talking about a small staff like that, that they've actually been getting some rest, because you can't work 24/7 for more than 48 hours. You know, then it becomes really problematic.
Absolutely. If I keep doing that, I'm going to be asking Folgers for a sponsorship, because I think I'm keeping the lights on at least one of their warehouses.
That won't be enough unless you can mainline it.
Yeah.
So here we are, and I guess what's on everybody's mind, and we've sort of touched on it, but just to make it something easy, you're in a situation where you've got damage, you've got nowhere to turn, place to call the Salvation Army?
Salvation Army, the American Red Cross is a good resource, and we're also bringing in some more groups as well, because we get to this point where in the business we call it long-term recovery, right? You lose the media attention, the boots on the ground that came from far and wide fade out because the emergency itself is gone, but now the weight of that emergency falls on the property owners, the business owners, the homeowners. So this long-term recovery group, we're actually meeting Wednesday. So this is a group that we pulled from statewide, and it's basically every non-government organization that activates in disaster.
Good.
So we bring them into the table. They meet with a lot of the locals that have been doing the work thus far, and we basically see, you know, we we put together this task force, and we bring up all of the problems and the issues that are ongoing, and whoever can help with that particular issue becomes a part of that specific task force. So this is something that we do that's kind of a long-term assistance for the community.
And that's great. With that in mind, it'd be wonderful if there was a one-stop shopping place where somebody would have a phone number they could call for somebody who would be answered, who'd be able to say, okay, we've got this, this, and this now. Here's what you can do. Is that in the works at all?
So we had it going during the emergency, but staffing-wise, right? Like I said, we're two people. So right now, we're just utilizing the government offices the best that we can, health and community services in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But once we get this stood up and we get some more folks in here to help people out, there will be a lot more direct contacts. Like, for example, when Team Rubicon came in, initially we were fielding the calls in our call center that was activated, that 928-402-8888 number. But once Team Rubicon got established, they started taking those calls direct. So that helps because the call load coming in, even for the call center, did become overwhelming at times.
Oh, sure. But ultimately, that's what I think sounds to me, based on everything we're saying, that that's what we need. We need a number that people can call, and then they're directed from that. Because when you're at that point where you don't know where to turn, I mean, you're not thinking that clearly either. I mean, that's just an absolute mess.
Yes. And so luckily we did have that call center operating for, oh gosh, a little over a month.
Good.
And they actually built out a client list. They've got contact information for just about everyone that either had a damage assessment done or called in asking for some sort of assistance. So we actually have that client list, and that's going to be something that we are sharing with that long-term recovery group, because that client list has basically Johnny homeowner listed. Here's the help that he requested. Here's what he's still missing. So we can take that client list to this group and say, okay, these people need this, this, and this. Who can help with that? And then we have a group step up, and then they're making contact with those residents.
Now, that's great. If there are people who didn't get on the client list for whatever reason who are still saying, I need to be on that list, can they call someone?
They can still call that 928-402-8888.
Okay.
And leave a voicemail there. We still have one or two staffers that are returning the calls that came in there. We just, unfortunately, do not have all the additional resources we pulled in.
And you won't get a whole bunch of answers, but maybe this will get you on the list. So I would advise that 928-402-8888. Leave your particulars, you know, don't make it the entire phone book, but of particulars on there, and, you know, someone will call you back. You won't necessarily get answers, but you'll be in the system where you will get answers from somebody.
Absolutely, and that's a lot of it, you know, in the early beginnings, those emergent requests, like, that's stuff that's easy to fill. But as sad as it is, a lot of the calls that came in towards the end were just things that government can't really help people with, stuff that insurance would need to, you know?
Right, and if you don't have insurance, and maybe that's where those SBA loans come into play, that may be the answer, because I think that's, you know, the underside of this is that far too many people are going to find out that they have no coverage for this.
Correct, and one of the biggest things that was coming up that was the hardest to deal with was roofs. But a lot of people with, you know, issues with their roof due to the amount of rain and the winds and everything. And when we had Team Rubicon in here, they were going out and helping people tarp them off. And, you know, that's, of course, a temporary thing. But then now that the day's ended and these people have gone home, we've got homeowners saying, well, hey, no one's come to fix my roof yet. Where do we go from here? And if they're not insured, that's unfortunately the end of the road unless we can bring someone else in to help.
Right. Absolutely. So it's not going to be easy for a lot of people, and it's not going to be over anytime soon. But at least we've got some resources going and a number that if you're not hearing from anybody, especially if you think you're on this list, you're hearing from nobody, there's no action, call again.
Absolutely.
928-402-8888. Yeah. Thank you for stepping in, Carl. Is there anything I missed that you'd like to bring up?
Oh, gosh. So I do want to just kind of give a general overview of how disaster funding works, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So one of the things that we hear so commonly in this business from the public is, you know, when FEMA shows up and they're, you know, when the FEMA money comes, that's not exactly how it works. To kind of break it down, right? So from the government standpoint, if we have a county level disaster, all that really does for us is allow for easier spending, right? Because if I need something done in an emergency, we don't have time to go through a procurement process. So we can go through emergency procurement, which is an established, much faster process. So not much of a change. Then we get to a state level emergency, which typically means that the county has expended their limit on an emergency, which is usually in the neighborhood of $800,000. So when the state issues an emergency declaration, that means that our eligible expenses for emergency response are eligible for reimbursement at 75%.
Okay.
Now, if we get to the level of a federal emergency, which is typically around $13 million, then we can become eligible for up to 90% reimbursement. That's the only real differentiator there. However, that's the public assistance side of FEMA. The flip side of that coin is the individual assistance, which is assistance funding to a property or homeowner. In order to have that for disaster, to qualify to apply for that, you have to have 650 homes destroyed, which we do not, or 7.5 million in homes destroyed, which again, we do not. And that's the unfortunate part that makes this system difficult to navigate for rural Arizona.
Horrendous, because when you talk about that 90%, that sounds so good. And then you hear how many million you have to have in damage and the likelihood that you can substantiate that, because it's not only what you say it is, it's what they come and appraise it at.
100%. So. And that goes for the infrastructure as well.
Yeah.
So if we as Gila County say we spent this much money on this bridge and it was destroyed, we need to rebuild it, FEMA may come back and say, well, it's actually worth this much, so that's how much you're going to be eligible for reimbursement on. So we see a lot of the same issues.
Well, there's going to be a lot to discuss in the future, so I'll impose of you to come back, and I also want you to call us if there's anything you want the public to know at any time, because we'll do it. You know,
absolutely.
That.
So, absolutely. But if you could, in the meantime, share out the SBA loans availability. I know that's sometimes a scary thing, but if you're in need of help, that may be the best option on the table, is applying for an SBA loan.
And is there any easy way to get that contact? Do you know any?
Right now, they're set up in the Chamber of Commerce during their regular business hours.
Okay, all right. Go to the Chamber of Commerce then.
Absolutely.
Regular business hours. And at least get the information. Even if you're afraid of a loan or saying, you know, I don't know if I can do this, or I want to do this, or I'll qualify for this, check it out.
It doesn't hurt to ask.
Yeah.
And you're not committing to anything until you're at the end of the day signing a piece of paper. So if you just want to go in and ask questions, that's why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for coming.
Of course, of course.
All right, so Carl Melford, and we'll be hearing from him again, and we appreciate all you did, because that was, man, that was a lot of work.